It's another busy day in the world of news, but State Representative Arthur O'Neill has been kind enough to take a little time out from the work of the House Select Committee of Inquiry. He is one of the two chairmen of that House committee. This is the committee, of course, investigating the whole matter of impeachment for Governor Roland. And Representative O'Neill is here with us right now for a very quick interview. Hi, thanks for doing this.
You're very welcome.
Let's just begin with some of the stuff that's been appearing in the press. There seems to be quite a bit of speculation about just the pace of work for the committee. This is an enormous task. There are thousands of documents to be examined and a lot of different angles to be looked at. And we're hearing all kinds of different dates for, you know, when the committee might be able to wrap up its work. What's your best guess at this point?
Well, I don't think it makes any sense to try to pick a particular date. That just gives some people who are seeking to delay us a target date to work towards. We will proceed as expeditiously as we can. We are going to do a thorough, comprehensive investigation, which is what the resolution the House passed called for, and we will do it as quickly as possible. We hope, we believe that it might be possible to get things wrapped up by summer. And that is a bit indefinite, but that's about the best that I can give you as a target.
When you say thorough and comprehensive, I assume what you're wanting us to understand is that, unlike what has been suggested by some people, it's not going to be the case that you're going to narrow the focus down to, like, dirt bikes or hot tubs. You're going to look at everything?
We are going to look at everything that seems to be potentially fruitful, where we could find what the facts are without having undue delay, of having to go through extensive litigation. So we are not going to limit it to just one or two of the items that you've been reading about in the newspapers. We are going to continue on a relatively broad basis, although even now some of the places we started looking, or we have been looking, we seem to have exhausted the available information, and we've reached a point where we don't think it's fruitful to continue going around talking about that one and have redeployed resources to focus on the other areas that still have lots of undetermined facts.
Now, let's get to the other issue that seems to be very prominent right now, and that is the issue of deposing people in secret, something to which the governor's legal counsel, Ross Garber, is strenuously objecting. Can you just speak a little bit about this, about how you understand this issue?
Well, we have called for depositions of some individuals who, for one reason or another, have been unwilling or unable to speak with our investigators in essentially private conversations where our investigators take notes and prepare reports, which they return to our chief counsel, Stephen Reich. And so what we have is a situation where in order to get this information and to provide some modicum of confidentiality for what they're going to say to us, we chose to go through the deposition route. Depositions are very commonly used in all forms of litigation, and they were used extensively in investigations that you've read about relating to Watergate and the Clinton investigation and so on. There were lots of depositions. So this is nothing unique or unusual or at all different from what other people have done. Depositions are routinely done in private. They are not public meetings of the committee. They are not public hearings of the committee. Depositions constantly go on in private litigation and even in public litigation, and there is no disclosure of all of this. Now, what we have said is that in order for the governor to be given as much fairness as we can, more than anybody else would normally get in any kind of litigation, he is going to get a copy of the transcript of the deposition once the witness has reviewed it for accuracy and determined that there are no corrections that need to be made. It will be given to the committee, and then we will promptly turn it over to the governor's office so that they will have the opportunity to review it. If they think there are things that need to be refuted, they can provide us with evidence. If they think they want to talk to this witness themselves, they can do that. Obviously, they'd have to get the cooperation of the witness in some of these cases. But most of the people we're talking to or trying to talk to are people who have some sort of a relationship with the governor's office. For example, Attorney Cicchetti, who was the governor's former personal attorney, as just one example of someone, or his scheduler, who is someone who works for the governor's office. So we assume that those people, if they have a question about what those folks said, that Attorney Dow or Attorney Garber could perhaps ask questions of them, and if they think that somehow the testimony was inaccurate or that the person answered incorrectly or by mistake, they can bring all of that to our attention and provide us with additional information.
Can the person who is being deposed, do they have counsel present if
Yes.
they want to?
Yeah, okay. Yep. In fact, I just greeted the first person who is going through a deposition when she arrived at the committee room, and her attorney, and they both entered the committee room, sat down, and began their depositions, and he can object to questions, and he can counsel his client so that the witness has every opportunity to receive the benefit of counsel.
So what you're saying basically is, A, this is not a trial, and B, if it were a trial, the stage that we're at right now really wouldn't be a situation where depositions would be conducted in public or with somebody out, like the governor's counsel necessarily having access to them anyway.
That's absolutely true. And if you look at the depositions that were done in other investigations of this type, that is impeachment inquiries, at no time were, for example, President Clinton's attorneys present at the depositions. They were present at the hearings that, and the presentation of evidence, whether they were in executive session or in public hearing in front of congressional committees, but they were not present at any depositions that were conducted. I will say that President Clinton did have his counsel present, but then so will Governor Rowland if we were to have some sort of a hearing. President Clinton testified in deposition rather than appear before the committee personally. And the deposition he testified in was a grand jury deposition, and that one he did have his attorneys present.
We're talking to Arthur O'Neill, who's one of the co-chairmen of the House Select Committee of Inquiry. Your fellow co-chairman, I think it was anyway, John Wayne Fox, was quoted in the paper today as saying, ultimately, this will be the most open process of its kind you ever saw. Is that a conviction that you share?
Yes, we are providing a great deal more information and opportunity for information to be given to the governor than has been the case in other impeachment inquiries, and I believe more of our proceedings will be in public when it comes to the point of actually presenting evidence to the committee, and to a large extent when we are collecting evidence in front of the committee or in front of agents of the committee, such as these depositions, which will become very quickly available to the governor. And obviously, if he wants to disclose them publicly, there's not much we can do to stop him from doing that.
Arthur O'Neill, we promised this would be short. We do thank you very much. Representative O'Neill, co-chairman of the House Select Committee, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was nice of him to do that.
Yeah.
Middle of a very, busy day.
The reason that I was kind of hustling them through, they're basically, the committee's rolling right now. I don't know whether he was on a break or what, but I kind of begged them to spend some time with us if there was a little window. I just think it's sort of important to get all that stuff out, because I think we're all a little bit transfixed by some of the 9/11 stuff, by Iraq, by the Middle East, by the fact that President Bush seems to have morphed into Forrest Gump. And it, as a result, it's kind of hard to, it's easy to sort of, forget this whole thing. Plus there's, the last night of The Apprentice tonight, and some big things happened in American Idol last night. So, you get this impeachment thing, and it can get away from you pretty easily. Did you have something you wanted to share?
Well, I was thinking about this thing you mentioned yesterday, the thing with Jamie Gorelick.
Yeah.
And they were a congressman, I guess, was Sensenbrenner.
Yeah.
Wanted her to resign because she had written memos and had some interactions with some of the witnesses and all. I was thinking about that this morning. I was out walking. I was thinking perhaps if she'd gone duck hunting with some of the witnesses, made things better. Maybe they wouldn't have been quite so concerned about it.
Well, first of all, if she'd gone duck hunting with anybody for the FBI, they wouldn't have found any ducks. As a matter of fact, the ducks would be like
ducks would have
been swimming by, and the people in the FBI would be going, as far as we can tell, there are no ducks here. So we have no actual indication that there are ducks. We do hear quacking. There's feathers in the water. There's duck poop everywhere. But as far as actual ducks, we don't see them.
No ducks.
No ducks here.
It's great, isn't it, though, the name of that brief that the CIA didn't recognize.
Well, it almost has kind of a children's book quality,
too. It's incredible.
It's called The Zacharias Goes Flying. No, it's close, though. The Islamic extremist learns to fly.
What more do you need to say?
And the Special Counterterrorism Unit, as I said before the show was starting today, now has uncovered another memo titled, Guys with Box Cutters Are Going to Get on Planes and Fly Them into Buildings Next Tuesday, which, unfortunately, was too muddy for anybody to really be able to interpret. But
if their specific time had been there, maybe they could have done something about it. But since that was left out...
Well, the Gorelick thing is interesting, too, for this reason.
two Republicans on the commission that I am aware of have told Sensenbrenner, who's a Republican, in so many words to shut up. One of them is Thomas Kane, who's the chairman of the committee, who said something like, why doesn't he mind his own business? And then Lehman, who I think is, the former Navy Secretary, yep. John Lehman.
The Admiral.
He's a Republican commissioner also. Also said at the end of this thing, he described Sensenbrenner's assertion in two words. That's baloney. These are Republicans on the commission. And this tells me there's an interesting parallel between the 9/11 commission and the House Select Committee here in Connecticut, which is at a certain point, panels like this develop kind of a siege mentality. They decide that they have a lot more in common with each other than they do with all the idiots who are hassling them about various things. And you can see this happen. I mean, it's clearly happened here in the 9/11 commission where, Gorelick is a Democrat. He's a former Clinton administration official, former deputy attorney general. And the minute she was attacked by a Republican, two Republicans from the 9/11 commission jumped in front of her and said, wait just a second, back off. And that tells me the 9/11 commission now has an identity that exceeds their political affiliations or whatever baggage they came in there with. They are, they're getting pretty attached to each other. And I think the same thing is happening here in Connecticut on the House Select Committee. Basically, I think you're seeing a bipartisan consensus form, and the people who are going through this, in each case, these people have a tremendous workload, a tremendous amount of public scrutiny and public pressure, and a very tough job to do in a very short amount of time. That will create a siege mentality. And I think they have it now, and I think they will probably hang together, irrespective of political differences.
All right, here's Gretchen in a car. Hi, Gretchen.
The bed for some commercial.
You're waiting for Bowie Thomas,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. I thought this was a commercial. I'm sorry. There's so much.
It's in the mood, I think.
We want to mention that Joe Lieberman is scheduled to join us in studio later on today, probably in the 5 o'clock hour. So stay tuned for that.
Is he going to announce he's getting back into the race?
Well, I don't think so, but we'll have a lot of interesting things to talk to him about, I'm sure. And we've got Tim on the line right now. I just wanted to say one other thing about one of the other things that came out yesterday. As long as we're on the 9/11 commission, they had this guy, Thomas Picard, who was at one point the acting director of the FBI. And you know how he said the other day that Louis Freeh didn't know how to do email?
Yeah.
And he'd like never send an email and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the computer system, basically, of the FBI was for years literally a joke. I mean, even Picard said this. The FBI computer system was considered the joke of Washington, D.C., But another joke is that Thomas Picard couldn't do email anyway because he can't type. And I think the FBI director should be able to type enough to be able to, answer some email and stuff. But this guy...
How difficult could it be?
Once a year, he would send out an email to all FBI employees urging them to share their concerns. And then his secretary would print out the replies, and he would take them home and go over them and stuff.
Homeowners, would you like to eliminate the...
Hey, you know what I saw in here today? What's that? Some incredible things that, Bobby Sherwood is very accomplished at many things.
Mm-hmm.
But we also found out today he's a hell of a cleaning guy.
Yeah, everybody's running around cleaning stuff here today.
It's cleaning day. That's why. Yeah. You know what happened? Remember Big Drunk Larry that used to work here?
Yep.
Excuse me.
They find him dead behind a stack of things?
Just found him on Dunaway's desk. Yeah. Okay, that's what that big pile has been in there for the last 3 years.
I thought I smelled rotting flesh.
How could you tell in that room?
Yeah, you probably couldn't. Well, there's a lot of big things going on in the world, but let's not forget, tonight's the last night of The Apprentice.
Oh, God.
And, somebody from the Slate, somebody named Daniel Gross, stole my idea, which is that what this show has really revealed is that Donald Trump hates himself because he's gotten rid of all the contestants that were anything like him, and particularly Troy McClain, who absolutely should have Although, actually, well, we'll come to this later, but Troy McClain is the closest thing to Donald Trump. But there were a lot of other contestants who are kind of like Trump in different ways. And he got rid of all of them. All the sort of edgy, brash, semi-vulgar, overreaching, but tough, tenacious. All those people that sort of have any of the qualities that we associate with Donald Trump, including being a mammoth pain in the neck, have been gotten rid of.
Is it because he doesn't like himself, or because he's afraid of himself?
Well,
that he recognizes himself as such staunch competition that he doesn't want any of those people.
Well, that's possible. That he doesn't want those people going for his throat. And what he's wound up with these two fairly bland people, Kwame Brown and Bill Rancic. Kwame Brown is the guy from the Wizards. Actually, that brings to mind, though, a great moment in the series where at one point they had, because they were sort of one of the teams that was kind of running behind on money that it was supposed to raise, this guy Troy McClain. And here's a very Trump-like move. He came up with the idea of having this young African-American guy, Kwame Jackson, who's kind of a, he's an NBA kind of guy and stuff like that. They had him sitting outside, some big sports venue, signing basketballs and stuff, and based on the idea that he was Kwame Jackson. The only thing that they said was, Kwame Jackson, want to have John Kwame Jackson sign a basketball for you? So, and people were coming up and getting stuff signed and paying for it and stuff. Just on the idea that there was somebody named Kwame Jackson sitting there. He must be somebody important. He must be an athlete.
Isn't that bordering upon fraud?
Well, there's a lot of things that have happened on this series that are either bordered on fraud or have kind of crossed the line into questionable areas of ethics. Although, for that, they are rarely... I mean, they often get rebuked gently by the Donald, but nobody has ever really been punished for this. But so anyway, tonight is the striking two-hour, I believe, live finale. And there have been some interesting things that have kind of come out of this series, including the development of a black woman that you're on television that you're allowed to hate. You know, I mean, it's so politically incorrect to do this. And I haven't quite decided what the phenomenon of Omarosa really represents. I mean, this woman has become incredibly famous. Now Maya Rudolph is playing her on Saturday Night Live. And just everywhere you go, there's stuff going on about this woman. And she, I think what's sort of interesting about this is that she really is a royal pain in the neck. It's not the case that they've sort of... I mean, you can do a lot of stuff with editing on a TV show like this. And you can certainly select clips and stuff like that to make somebody look either a lot better than they are or a lot worse than they are. But I don't think that's the case with Omarosa. I think she really is just a grade A pain in the neck. And it just, the level of fascination that people now have. And here's an example of some really hard-hitting journalism. Dateline last night devoted its entire show, hosted by journalist Stone Phillips, to behind the scenes of The Apprentice. So they showed audition tapes, they had background interviews, they had, and basically one of the things that was revealed about Kwame is that his marriage broke up because he's basically a slut. He announced to the camera that he just realized that his marriage broke up because he had years of skirt chasing ahead of him, he said. It's kind of an interesting thing to admit about yourself on television. And
we got about 40 dates out of it.
Yeah, probably. All of these people, I would imagine, would have become very... I mean, most of them are single, and except not Omarosa. I can't go out with her. She has a sort of long-suffering-looking husband. But it just... I don't know. The phenomenon of The Apprentice. The one thing that I concluded last night is everything is soft. The Donald really doesn't do the things that he used to do quite as well. And I guess his financial empire is very shaky right now, and the casinos aren't performing all that well and stuff like that. The sort of hardware stuff, the building of things and the actual creation of stuff, I get the feeling he doesn't do that as well as he used to. And what is working and what's going to work even more is just slapping his name on various things and having the cachet that The Apprentice has now provided him. With almost anything with the word Trump on it is going to take off, at least for a little while, until people get tired of this. And like everything is soft, Dateline devoted its hour. I mean, what a soft journalism thing to do to come, but nobody really does anything real. and these people, when they're given tasks to do, the tasks are often pretty soft tasks. I mean, they don't really represent, once again, the creation of anything. Like one of the sort of big projects that I guess it was Kwame's team had, it was Kwame's team had to do, was to arrange a Jessica Simpson concert and handle all the details of a Jessica Simpson concert at one of the casinos. I'm thinking actually a greater service to humanity would have been provided if they had been successful in thwarting Jessica Simpson from actually performing somewhere, which they almost did by accident.
What about a, you know, to take this one step further, since you know there's going to, this is going to spawn some kind of, you know, spinoff or whatever, I would think. How about a Connecticut government version of this thing?
The Apprentice, that's a good
idea.
The
Apprentice.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe you can have Roland like the, in the part of Trump.
You're impeached.
Well, so yeah, that might work.
Yeah. See, maybe every week they would try to impeach him.
That's a better idea.
That's pretty much how it's working these days anyway. But, you might be onto something. You know, take the idea of the Apprentice and apply it. I don't think you would... I think, actually, the goal would be to get off the Roland team as opposed to actually get a job there. Every week... You would try to do something to make it possible for you to leave. You know, that is the way it's working now. You know, basically, you know, the Kwame Brown of all this is going to be, or Kwame Jackson. I got to stop calling him Kwame Brown. The Kwame Jackson of all this is going to be Dean Pagani, who's like stuck there at the end, and everybody else has gotten out. Everybody else, you know, Boomer's back in Nebraska, and Larry Cohen is back writing his infuriating columns in the paper, and like, everybody just gets out. Except poor Dean. Dean's got nowhere to go. It's a great idea, actually. I love that idea. Well, fortunately, the demographics of this show, I mean, it's getting great ratings overall, finishing around third or fourth in the ratings, I think, overall. The demographics are killer. It's like people who have some money to spend and could be influenced by commercials. Those are the demographics of this thing. And it costs, you know, very little to produce. You know, Donald is not getting as much as, you know, Joe and Matt LeBlanc per episode. So it's cheap to do, and the demographics are great. So they'll run this thing for 2 or 3 years until people can't stand it anymore. Do you want to know what happened on American Idol last night?
Yeah, I'm
sitting about that too.
Breathlessly waiting for this.
Basically, I was watching American Idol last night, and I was thinking, if if Martians came down...
Look at
this is after I had to go up to Springfield last night for this book signing where I knew there was nobody was going to buy my book. It was like two books I sold. So anyway.
That was worth a trip then.
Yeah, I got back really fast from Springfield, so I had time to watch American Idol.
Got back before you left.
Yeah. And I was watching this thinking if aliens came down from another planet and looked at American Idol, they would conclude that there was this incredibly talented, spirited, able, vivacious race of creatures known as African Americans, and then these kind of defective, you know, people who are just clinging to life by, you know, a thread known as white people. The black people on American Idol they blow you away every single day. This woman, Fantasia, last night sang Summertime as well as you can sing Summertime. I mean, you know, if this had been gymnastics, it just would have, even the East German judge would have given her a 10. Everybody would have given her a 10. And this woman, Latoya London, also did a spectacular song at the end of the show. And then they have, like, these two white guy goons who come out, and they're just like, I mean, they're so bad. You just sit there and you think, Simon can't say a mean enough thing at the end of this.
Wherever they play the funny rhythm they play, it started on Journal Square. And somebody heard it there.
You know, when you think about the testimony yesterday from the September of the 9/11 Commission,
mm-hmm.
The more that I think about it, the thing that's weird about all this is that one of the things that we heard is that there was this threat spike in the summer of 2001 where, you know, on a daily basis there was more and more information coming in about the danger from these terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, people were running around with their hair on fire. Tenet and Richard Clark and people like that were running around, metaphorically speaking, with their hair on fire. And so President Bush was in Crawford, Texas for the entire month of August.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he's in constant touch.
Yeah, and then that's the thing. Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot been made about the fact that he was briefed every day by George Tenet. Well, that's not true when he's in Texas, as we found out. As a matter of fact, Tenet thought he hadn't talked to Bush during that entire month, and then it subsequently that was corrected to say that there might have been one or two times when he was. But
the perception, too, I mean, what does that look like to you know, to the public? What's it look like to the public when we've had it here in this state with governors? I mean, when the head of state or the head of the country is off doing whatever, I mean, I suppose he has a right to, you know, be wherever he wants, but you'd kind of like to think the guy that's at the top was, you know, at the controls.
Actually, before he took off on that vacation, USA Today did a story pointing out that the vacation, which was scheduled to last from August 3rd to September 3rd, would tie one of Richard Nixon's as the longest that any president had ever taken.
Well, you know, you need that vacation time.
And, you know, yes, of course he is sort of in touch, and he does. But for example, on August 6th, he got this presidential briefing, the PD, the famous PDB, on August 7th, and here I'm indebted to Fred Kaplan from Slate Magazine, who we keep trying to get on here, we never can, but he writes that on August 7th, the day after that, that memo was received, the president, quote, was in an expansive mood when he ran into reporters while playing golf. So, you know, I mean, I guess maybe everybody else was excited and worried about all these warnings of terrorism and stuff like that, but it seems very incongruous to think that he was on vacation for an entire month.
A lot of brush got cut, though. Let's keep that in mind.
I mean, you know, they always say, you know, one of the things that Condoleezza Rice said in terms of the fact that they weren't really kind of ready for this and they didn't really have their terrorism policies in place and stuff, she said, you know, we only had 244 days and we'd only been in office this very short time. Well, it's kind of amazing when you talk about that. You finally get arguably the most important job in the world. You work at it for 7 months, no, not even that, 6 months, and say, okay, I got to take a month off. I mean, if you want to be president, stick around and be president. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you get a little bit of rest time just to, you know, cool down and clear your head and stuff like that. You need a month off, and then don't come to us and say, well, we hardly had any time in office. We couldn't really get anything done about terrorism because look at how, well, then don't take a month off if, you know, if you're so pressed for time.
Right. Well, John Dean mentioned it yesterday, right, that he's just one of those guys that isn't comfortable in the White House. He has to get out.
Right. You've got to leave. Anyway, we have Joe Lieberman live and in studio coming up here later in the show today. We do have time in the next hour to take your calls about this and other topics. Our numbers are 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC if you have a cell phone. All right, we're back. And, you know, I just, before we get into anything else, I wanted to bring up a little story that I found very heartwarming. Because it's important in these times of trouble, in these times of duress.
Okay.
And not to forget about our friends in the rat poison industry. Because, in fact, rat poison is one of the things that really makes America go. And over the past 6 years, there have been pernicious attempts.
Can I just ask something?
What?
What causes you to have interest in things like rat poison?
Well, because...
What is it? What,
I think...
Why?
What I think actually is missing, and what even makes you puzzled, is the fact that the rat poison industry hasn't done a good job of doing those kind of big, kind of industry-wide montage commercials,
yeah,
you know, about
maybe how
rat poison is America's brain food or whatever. Well, anyway, for the past 6 years, the rat poison industry has bravely and courageously fought off efforts by meddling environmentalists and regulators.
Yeah, they can be awful sometimes.
Who are trying absurdly to protect children and wildlife from eating rat poison.
The nerve.
Where my grandfather actually said, eat a little rat poison every day, and, you know, by the time you get big, you can eat a whole piece of rat poison. the purpose of being able to do that, I was nervous. But he believed in Mr. Data Community, is what I'm saying, I guess. But anyway, the proposed child safety regulations were abandoned after more than 5 years of study, and an assessment of the impact of rat poisons on wildlife has been bogged down for about 3 years. And along the way, the Environmental Protection Agency gave the industry a rare opportunity to revise regulatory language for 15 months after it was in near final form. Basically, what the EPA eventually wound up doing is going to the rat poison industry and saying, just out of curiosity, what do you think the rules ought to be? You know, before we jump in here with our own nutty ideas. And so, this is the way the Bush administration does everything, by the way. If there's any attempt being made to regulate any kind of industry, what they do is they go to the industry and say, out of curiosity, what could you live with? What would be okay? You know, tell us your wish list. And so that's what they did. Basically, they let the they gave the industry access to bog down the federal action. And one unidentified EPA official in one memo said, he wrote that he was, quote, concerned that for a year the broad stakeholder community has been shut out. Some are asking why. That's a shut out of the rat poison rulemaking process. And now the term...
I can't believe we're talking about this.
The term broad stakeholder community here would include not only the people who make the rat poisons, but the people who eat the rat poisons. The people who make the rat poisons were included in the whole process in terms of making up rules for what the rat poisons should be like. The people who eat the rat poisons were completely...
Why are people eating rat poisons?
Well, in fact, and this is something we can all be proud of, last year, 15,000 children younger than six accidentally ate rat poison, up from a mere 11,000 a decade ago. So...
How many rats do we have in this country? I mean,
well, we have lots of rats because most of the rat poison is either eaten by children or deer, as far as I can tell.
Rats never eat it.
The rats,
rats are like,
the rats
are in touch with stuff.
Yeah. And it's not only kids and deer, too. For example, the other day I caught Mikey C. and Bobby, our producers, eating rat poison. They said, look at the new candy. It's rat poisson, some kind of French candy. It's not rat poison. Don't eat it. And currently, they proposed new child safety regulations, and then the industry kind of got involved and kind of, you know, drove those away.
Well, you can certainly understand why they'd want to do that.
Yeah, they don't want
we don't want kids to be protected. God, we don't want to start something here that, you know, we can't sustain.
So instead of making the rat poisons a little bit safer and less likely to kill you if you eat them, they decided to require stronger labeling. And precautionary
Good. So kids, you know how kids are.
Big labels.
Kids are always checking out the label.
Warning: do not eat this unless you are a rat. Is what the is what they say now. So, but anyway, the whole idea of this was is that once again, the Bush administration's even the rat poison industry has more clout than you do as a like. I understand that big oil, and that Halliburton,
big rat.
War profiteers like Halliburton. I understand that they are going to have a lot more access to the Bush administration. I understand that the utility industry will be able to meet with Dick Cheney, and whereas, you know, environmentalists won't stuff. But you kind of think the rat poison industry, like they're that powerful that they can completely dominate the rulemaking policy about rat poison? It seems to me that in the rulemaking policy about rat poison, you should have another voice. I mean, at least get some, depose some rats. Ask them how they feel about it. But, you know, certainly don't talk to any parents groups or consumer groups or environmental groups or anything like that. And not only is it unsafe for all those people, but then the deer eat the rat poison, and then the hunters shoot the deer, and they eat the deer that are full of rat poison. So think about that.
Yep.
Think about that as your gun-wielding, drunken hunter nut who thinks he's on the other side of this issue. Mr. Drunken, gun-wielding hunter nut who thinks he's on the other side of the rat poison issue for me, you'd be better off with some regulatory reform, buddy boy.
Guess you don't have to screen those calls, do you?
Oh... I just thought.
I'll look at the time. We're all out of time.
Warming little story. Yeah, let's talk about Chris Dibner. Actually, when we come back, dude, this is a great time for you to call in because I think we're going to have Arnold at 4:40. So call in the next little segment we have after the traffic and the endless commercials, and we'll talk to you then because then I think we may have Arnold at 4:40. We think maybe, and then Lieberman comes in here.
Is that difficult to get Arnold?
Well, we didn't know where to move Arnold to get. Lieberman's showing up at 5:10, and we could move Arnold to 5:40, but then Lieberman won't get here at 5:10. We'll have to have Lieberman on at 5:40. Senator Lieberman, that is.
I see.
Yeah.
So how long is he scheduled for?
Who knows?
Just whatever
he'd
like.
As long as he wants. He's the 800-pound gorilla, yeah.
I'm ready, Slick. Are you?
Oh, yeah. Take it down.
Girl, I must warn you. I've been thinking strange in my mind.
Yeah. Yo.
All right, we're back here, and this is a good time to call in if you want to. Our numbers are 522-WTIC or 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC. Call in about Iraq, 9/11, the impeachment process, The Apprentice, American Idol, or anything else.
Or Don's apology, or Jim Calhoun. Yeah. Jim Calhoun's going to be thrown out the first pitch Monday at Fenway, and he wouldn't go do it for the Yankees.
Yeah, thank you, Jim Calhoun.
Quite simply, that's quite frankly, that's quite a good idea.
So he stayed away from the dark side. That's a good thing.
Yep.
And if we have a minute here, nobody's calling in. Maybe we can quickly talk a little bit about the Chris Dodd thing. This is something we covered a lot when it was first
something
developed.
We didn't plan on covering it quite as much as we did, but
yeah.
We had a lot of calls.
We just got stuck on it for like an entire day, basically, almost. I guess he sort of had to apologize. Although, to tell you the truth, I mean, what he did was stupid, but, I mean, first of all, to equate Chris Dodd and Trent Lott, I mean, as the article in The Current today points out, the first thing you have to say about all this is there's no basis for supposing that Chris Dodd is a Klan sympathizer. Chris Dodd has, like, you know, the same people who are vilifying Chris Dodd right now, ordinarily vilify him for having such a liberal voting record and for siding with liberal causes, including civil rights. I mean, you know, he's obviously voted on the side of the angels for this stuff. The same cannot be said about Trent Lott. I mean, there's difference number one. Difference number two, Strom Thurmond was an unrepentant racist. You know, as late as 1998, he was asked about his participation in the 1948 segregationist Dixiecrat ticket, and he said he didn't regret anything. He'd do it all over again. Whereas Robert Byrd, when he was asked about the biggest mistake he ever made in his life by Bernard Shaw, he said, of course, it was joining the Klan. I regret it every day of my life. I don't know, you know, I mean, so there's another big difference. And then the last thing was, you know, what Trent Lott basically said is he wished Strom Thurmond got elected in 1948, and he said things would have been better. We wouldn't have all these problems now. Well, Dodd didn't say anything like that. He said that Byrd would have been a great senator at any time, from the framing of the Constitution, through the American Revolution, through the Civil War, through the international challenges faced by America during the 20th century. At any of those moments, Byrd would have been a great senator. It was stupid to bring up the Civil War, but it wasn't a racist comment. Joining us now is State Representative Mike Lawler. He's the co-chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and he's a member of the House Select Committee of Inquiry on Impeachment. And one of the things we're sort of trying to get ourselves up to speed on today is some of the things that have happened on that panel. First of all, welcome back, Representative Lawler.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Just fine. You know, I wouldn't have guessed a month or two ago that Governor Roland's lawyers would be arguing for a lot of things to be conducted in public that could be conducted in private. And I guess I can't ask you to take a trip into the mind of either Governor Roland or Attorneys Dow or Garber, but why are they requesting that depositions be taken in public, or at least with them present?
Well, I think you could speculate that one of their possible strategies is just to delay, or tactics, I should say, just to delay things in the hope that somehow the public mood will turn around, the legislative mood will turn around. But, you know, it's possible that if we were proposing to conduct all of this stuff in public, they might be arguing that it should be in private simply to cause some more delays. But that's just speculation.
Now, what's really happened, from what I can tell, and maybe you can sort of flesh this out a little bit, is it seems like it's possible that some things will be in public and some things will be in private. And I'm talking specifically about these depositions. It seems from the coverage today as though some people who've been called to give some kind of sworn statement want to do it in a public situation, which is pretty unusual. I can't really think of a situation where I've seen somebody give a deposition with an audience.
Well, you don't necessarily have to believe that is their sincere desire. That's simply a one way to get it delayed somewhat. And as I said, it's possible that the tactic that's been chosen at the moment is just to delay things for a while. But, you know, it's not at all unusual that, well, the rules we've adopted are virtually identical to the rules that have been used in other states and in the federal government during impeachment proceedings. So there's really nothing unusual about this process. And I have to just assume they're trying to delay things tactically.
Can you explain what this process is and what's actually happening now? In other words, I know the committee was in session today. What's actually going on right now?
Well, actually, the committee was not in session. Our investigators, our special counsel and the team of investigators, was conducting a deposition.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee, individual members could attend if they chose to, but only a few would be allowed to attend, because if we had a sort of a quorum, then it wouldn't actually be an official committee meeting, and then it would be subject to all of the normal public disclosure rules. So it's not an actual meeting, but it was just something more formal that was taking place at the Capitol, as opposed to the interviews that had been taking place throughout the state, conducted by individual investigators. It's different because it's under oath and it's a little bit more formal, but it's not an official committee meeting.
The other thing that's been talked about a lot here is sort of just how the committee's workload is, or the flow of work, or how soon things are going to get done. One deadline has already passed. There's another May one that's clearly not going to be met. I mean, what's your sense of this? I mean, obviously it's very dangerous at this point to make any kind of predictions on when you can be done. But do you have some kind of intuitive sense of how this is going to go?
Yeah, I think that most of the principals have said that, you know, a month or two is probably the range to make a decision. And I think right now the discussion that's taking place is whether we want to narrow things down to just several of the more obvious incidents that need to be investigated and leave it at that for the time being, or do we want to continue this very wide-ranging probe. I mean, there's a lot of allegations to work with here, so if you just pick a few, it might save some time. And after all, at the end of the day, the decision that needs to be made is whether or not the governor should be removed from office. Not for how many reasons, it's just, you know, whether or not you think there's a basis to recommend that.
Will there be a point at which the committee begins having kind of regular hearings? And I'm not saying analogous to the September 11th ones, but where a lot of these key witnesses will sort of just testify in some kind of open hearing?
Well, that's the plan. You know, what's going on now is just part of the normal investigative process. First, people go out and talk to people informally. Then you get people under oath. And as you get closer to the real principal, then obviously that's the last step in the investigative process. And that's the part that would be in the normal sort of Watergate hearing style. And I think that's inevitable. Now, whether or not everyone decides to not testify, in other words, take the Fifth Amendment, remains to be seen. They imply that they're all prepared to do that. You know, the governor at one point did say he would cooperate fully and wants his opportunity to explain things, but whether or not he's really planning on doing that, we don't know. And a lot of the evidence is really documentary. You know, a lot of it is based on records of financial transactions and public statements made by the governor and others. So, I mean, there's a lot of evidence in that category, too. You don't really need formal witness to testify about everything. There's a few things that would be really helpful, and obviously the governor's explanation would certainly be useful, but whether or not he's prepared to give an explanation at any point, we still don't know.
Last question for you, Mike Lawler. First of all, is it contemplated, has the committee made a determination that it will call Governor Rowland as a witness at some point?
No, that decision has definitely not been made. And I think more than anything else, that's his decision more than our decision. You know, he's expressed an interest in having his opportunity to explain things, defend himself. Now, whether he means in front of the committee or in front of a statewide television audience, who knows? I would imagine that's really his decision to make. I mean, even if we subpoenaed him, he could certainly take the Fifth Amendment. Whether or not he'd survive long as governor, if he took the Fifth Amendment while governor, who knows? But that remains to be seen.
All right. Mike Lawler, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, Colin.
Bye-bye. Yeah. I think your idea of having it be more like The Apprentice, you know, is a good idea.
I think it could be developed. I don't have specifics yet,
right.
But
instead of having him appear before the House Select Committee, something like that, anyway. But I do think that it would be, the goal of the game would be to get away from it, not to get a job with it. Our numbers, if you want to talk right now, are 532.
Or get his job.
Or get his, well, that's, you know, well, I mean, look, you know, people like Kevin Sullivan, they don't even want to be in the succession. I mean, Kevin just doesn't want to be lieutenant governor, but 522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC, star WTIC if you have a cell phone. And we thought we would visit a little bit. We talked also earlier today to the Republican House Select Committee Chairman Arthur O'Neill, just to try to get an idea of what's going on here. Because there's a lot of stuff being reported in the press that makes you wonder. I mean, I had people calling me up from out of state today who kind of been following this thing for various reasons, saying, well, you kind of almost read it. It almost seems like a question about whether or not, you know, they're going to even be able to impeach him. And I think based on what I'm hearing, based on the two conversations that we had today with members of the committee and stuff, I think that they're not going to fizzle out or peter out. That's not the mood that I'm getting from this committee anyway. I mean, I think they'll take this thing as far as they have to go with it, whether or not they'll vote to impeach. Well, I am still confidently predicting a 10-0 vote to impeach. I think every member of the committee will vote to impeach. But
that's when the fun begins.
And yeah, that's where things get really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what they do as a matter of scheduling, because imagine, I mean, the work of the committee could be vastly compressed if, as Mike Lawler suggests, virtually everybody who's in any sense a stakeholder takes the fifth, which is certainly a big possibility. I mean, there might be some people, some low-level people, givers of hot tubs and stuff, who maybe they would talk, who knows. And there are some people, I mean, who I guess have no reason not to talk. I mean, they just they are not in danger of incriminating themselves. But, you know, if the Elifs and the Tomasos and the, you know, people like that, if they all take the fifth, then the work speeds up a little bit. but I would assume that this committee doesn't take a vote probably until June. Now, imagine this. They take a vote and they vote to impeach. Then what do you do? Because, in fact, I mean, at that point, you're in for a long, hot summer. People kind of want to go away. And I think we'd have sort of a Watergate-type summer, though. I mean, I think that the process would kind of have to go forward at that point. And there'd be the vote in the House and then the trial in the Senate. So if you're a state senator, you might want to get your vacation in now. TIC, or Star WTIC. And some of the things we talked about here so far today, of course, the impeachment process. Also, the fact that the 9/11 hearings, the wheels coming off in Iraq. Alarmingly, however, I mean, this really is a time where I believe that President Bush is just incredibly vulnerable. I mean, I do think that people are starting to realize that the emperor has no clothes, that this guy, the emperor has no clue in this case. And on the other hand, boy, I just wish John Kerry were a better candidate. Yesterday, he was in some New York school reading to kids, reading like a picture book to kids.
Yeah.
And he was forgetting to hold the book up and show them the pictures. And Senator Clinton, Hillary Rodham Clinton, had to say, John, hold the book up so that they can see it. This guy, I don't know, there's just something, you know, strangely detached about him. And he is boxed in on a couple of major issues, including, well, let's go to Rick from West Hartford. Never mind. We've got more important things to talk about. The Apprentice.
Hey, Colin, how are you doing today?
Fine.
I just want to say that...
No. Well, I don't know whether you need headphones or not. Pull the microphone closer to you. Do what we tell you to, and you'll be fine. No harm will come to you.
Wait a minute. This is a United States Senator.
I know, but part of the subject is a nauseating spectacle of him hugging Arnold Dean.
Jump all over this man every time he comes in.
You know,
in
that's
here.
Why I came back here, so I could hug Arnold Dean again.
The two of you should be touring in La Cage aux Folles the way things are going. Well, joining us now is Senator Joseph Lieberman, and we certainly want to apologize for a huge mistake that was made by our news department earlier this week, because they actually ran an item saying that you said that the president did a good job the other night, which I'm sure is some kind of...
Yeah, that's that other Joe Lieberman again. And no, I thought that he was, in that opening statement particularly, he made the best case he's made for not just why we went in there, but more to the point why we have to stay and finish the job. Now, of course, he gave that same speech in response to every question that was asked for the remainder of the evening, but except for what his biggest mistake was. But I did think that the opening statement was an important statement,
but,
and a good one.
On the other hand,
yes.
I mean, he has a job to do to explain to the American public why so many things... I mean, Terry Moran asked a question sort of saying, so many things seem to have become different from what you said they were. I mean, everyone's met. And he's done an inadequate job of explaining why we can't find weapons of mass destruction, you know, whether or not there was any real link between Saddam Hussein and terrorism. I mean, there's so many things that don't square up. I mean, that seemed to me the big failing there.
You mean the big failing in the press conference?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, no, he did not answer those. Look, I've been saying, and it's not that the past is irrelevant. It is not. But that we're at a point now where what's happening there is so critical, and people are losing their lives all around, that we got to figure out a way to come together and make it work. And the same day that he did his press conference, John Kerry had an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, and I thought, you know, there's slight differences in what he'd do now, but the basic point was, don't let anybody in Iraq or anywhere else in the world think that America's going to cut and run, or whatever phrase he used, if regardless of who the president elected is. But no, you're right. There's a history, and it's a burden on the president now that he emphasized the weapons of mass destruction to make the case for war, when there was a much larger case to be made, and it turned out that the weapons weren't there, that they weren't ready. His administration wasn't ready, prepared with what to do before the day Saddam Hussein fell. It was interesting, and I tried not to look back and say I told you so too much, but when General Shinseki, the former chief of the army, said before the war started that he thought we had many too few soldiers being sent to Iraq, particularly for the post-war, he was not only silenced, he was in some senses demeaned. And now I think everybody agrees that he was right. And, of course, the other night the president said, whatever General Abizaid tells me he needs, I'm going to give him. But that wasn't the case with the chief of the army. So you got me to say a few critical things about the president.
Well, the other thing that a lot of other people are saying is now we really got to go to the U.N. Now, we don't even have really enough credibility there in Iraq to do this by ourselves. Is that something that you're saying, too?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, in October of 2002, right around the time the resolution was adopted in the Senate to authorize the war, I began to think a lot about what should happen after we won, after we overthrew Saddam Hussein. And one of the things that I recommended was that we not send in an American to run post-Saddam Iraq, that we have an international administrator, hopefully somebody designated by the United Nations. Well, we're finally kind of working our way to that with Mr. Brahimi, who's the representative of Secretary General Annan, who's now negotiating the transfer, the elections, et cetera, et cetera. There's no question, the more the United Nations is involved in most of what's happening in Iraq, and we continue through NATO, hopefully, to oversee the stability, the security, military stuff, the better it's going to be. I do think that anybody who thinks that we're going to get large numbers of additional foreign troops to come in now is not being realistic. There's got to be a return to stability, and that's mostly going to come as a result of American forces and doing a better job to get the Iraqis. Rumsfeld says that we got 200,000 Iraqis ready to maintain security, but it doesn't look like they're really there.
I think a reasonable person would say that, you could neutralize one way or another Al-Sadr, or get him to the table or knock him off or whatever, and somebody else is going to come along and somebody else is going to come. We're going to be dealing with factions,
yeah,
and various zealots for a number of years to come. And I guess I'm asking you, in terms of your general prediction, how long is Iraq going to be the 51st state?
I can't predict. I mean, I'm afraid that what the president said the other night is right, as long as is necessary. I mean, we learned during the Bosnian conflict in the 90s, when the Clinton administration got negotiated into accepting a year deadline in a piece of legislation for our troops to be there, that you can't do that because you gotta say when the goal is achieved. And there's a lot of good things happening there, but nothing's going to get better until stability and security is restored, and that's going to take a big effort.
So years and years, right?
Could be years. I mean, look, if all goes well, there are some Shia clerics there who are really more, I hate to use the word moderate, but that's the most convenient word. At least they're not out to kill all Americans and et cetera. And if they begin to play a more aggressive role, as Ayatollah Ali Sistani, he's looking pretty good compared to Al-Sadr. Then I think and they've got a middle class, a talented group, intellectual leaders. And we can hold the elections by the end of the year or next January. Then there's some chance that this can go forward. But look, there's a small group there who don't want this to succeed. And this is very basic stuff. It's almost as if we need a great society program for Iraq. I mean, people. Unemployment is over 50%.
We are back in the 60s. There's no light at the end of the tunnel, and they need a great society program.
Well, all right, let's go back to the New Deal, then. Yeah. Whatever makes you feel more optimistic.
We have to take a little break. We're visiting with U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman, and we'll talk a little bit about what's going on in Israel in just a second. All right, we're back. So, we bring this kid in, who we paid $25 to pretend he wanted Lieberman's autograph, and he's standing there with a pen and a piece of paper for like 10 minutes.
I'm so grateful for the interest.
You are just so
and,
bad. And you're there saying,
you
well,
know, people used
name.
To rush up to me in Iowa, New Hampshire, ask for my autograph.
Are you interested in environmental policy?
He's a good kid, and you said that he thought I was Gino R.E.M., and he said no, that he knew who I was. This young man will someday be a leader of our country.
We had to give him 3 Jay-Z t-shirts to do this whole thing. I hope you're happy. I hope you had a good time.
Good, I did. Thank you. It meant a lot to me.
You know, we were talking a little bit about this off the air.
Yes.
John Kerry, should he win, Senator Kerry, should he win the presidency, is going to inherit a whopping deficit of fiscally irresponsibly managed federal government, a lot of environmental problems. Iraq is the 51st state. I could go on.
Yeah.
Is there any part of you? Are you? Maybe you're lucky you dropped out. Maybe it was a good thing.
You know, you are a good friend. It makes you feel positive about what happened. These are tough times ahead, and this administration has really been the most fiscally irresponsible in our history. I mean, we've got the largest long-term debt. There was a report that came out from the Medicare trustees a couple of weeks ago said that our unfunded liabilities, if we were a business and they were thinking about pension responsibilities, over $70 trillion. I mean, awful stuff. And let's hope the Iraq is in better shape. But John Kerry will be coming in at a tough time. But, I know him for a long time. We went to what's that place down in Haven together. And he's had a calling to public service for all his life. And I would say he's ready. Even in these times, he's ready.
Basically what they do, these guys from Houston came up here and applied the financial principles of Enron to the federal government. That's what we basically have, right?
It's worse than Enron.
Very quickly here, I do want to just quickly talk about the situation in Israel. We did have the president endorsing Sharon's unilateral pullout. I'm assuming this plays pretty well with you.
Well, we tried a lot of other things, and they haven't worked. I mean, to try to bring the Israelis and the Palestinians to the peace process, it's clear what the end point of this has to be, which is a two-state solution. We have Israel and Palestine. We have always said that we much favor bilateral ways to get to that, not unilateral. But the bilateral has not worked, and now I think Sharon is kind of putting something on the table, most unusual, which is I'll pull back some of the settlements, and I'm putting up this fence, but it's temporary, and let's begin to negotiate and put the challenge to the Palestinians, obviously in the first instance, hopefully to stop the terrorism, but at least to begin to think about negotiating around this proposal. A lot of news seemed to be made today that the president's acceptance of Israel's right to some of those settlements was historic, and it may be in a literal sense, but I think most administrations of this country since 67 have always known that that the two-state solution would allow the Israelis to keep some of the settlements, not some of the far-out ones.
The ones close to Jerusalem.
The ones closer to Jerusalem, and the whole Clinton-Barack negotiation and offer to Arafat in 2000 actually had, I'm not sure for sure, but most of these settlements that Sharon includes in the proposal as part of Israel. So let's hope it generates some reaction.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the whole question is how do you market this not only to the Palestinians, but to the Arab street? And it's going to get played over there as Bush endorses Sharon's, and Bush endorses Sharon's anything. Bush endorses Sharon's haircut. It's an inflammatory statement over there.
How do you feel about his haircut?
I prefer not to talk about it.
Yeah, all right.
I have some historical information about his haircut.
I'm not going to press you on it. This probably will short-term agitate some public opinion in the Arab world. It's true. But I think I think Sharon has offered a reasonable plan. It's a way to make progress. I agree with Bush in accepting it. Kerry, incidentally, did the same yesterday. And, what we're still lacking? We're still lacking any good news, any positive initiatives to the Arab world and the Islamic world. I will just get in a brief plug and tell you that last week, Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, Republican, and I put in a piece of legislation to make it as simple as I can. Not that you wouldn't understand the complexities, Colin, is really a Marshall Plan, an international Marshall Plan for the Arab world. You got to give the poor masses in the Arab world who live in generally dictatorial countries some hope for a better future than the death, suicidal death and hatred and religious war that Al-Qaeda offers them. And this administration has not done hardly any of that.
This is actually something that Clinton says over and over again. You know, it's going to cost a lot of money, but it's cheaper than going to war, it costs.
He does. You know, I read a speech a while ago that Clinton gave at a conference in Qatar on this subject. And, you know, and it was an audience that was mostly Arab.
Mm-hmm.
And he was brilliant. He made this point.
He's the same speech over and over again, but it is a good speech.
He does.
I'm sure you've never done that.
And of course, he gets very, very well paid for these speeches, They're high quality.
All right. Well, listen, we thank you very much for your time today. Go back out and get stuck in another traffic jam. Have a great time.
I'm going to Tom Ritter's red wine party.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Let them. This started when Ritter was the speaker, and I think he said...
They're going to subpoena everybody from that party tonight. So, you know, book some time, okay?
I have always said that I would do what I thought was right, regardless of the consequences.
I'd bring Hubie Santos with you if I were you.
We'll see you later.
We'll see you in a couple
wine.
Of years.
See ya.
Débarque, éteint le son pouvoir, la puissance de l'ombre s'installe. Non, ne résiste pas, ne lutte pas, ne te détourne pas de la main quand tu perçois où je vais explorer le royaume.
You know the way he clears his throat all the time, every time before he talks, it's like having Cokie Roberts gargling in here. After the great success of the baseball trip to Japan, the NFL has announced today that for the beginning of the season, the Patriots and Panthers will play on Mars. It's time for Sport Artois, the very French sports discussion segment of Monsieur Ronald Dean, Michel Bruce, and myself, Louis Gascon de la Mer.
They'll be going to the moon first.
No, they want to tap into that lucrative Martian TV market. Actually, before Arnold does his sportscast, is short. No, they want to tap into that lucrative Martian TV market. Actually, before Arnold does his sportscast, is short sportscast. Really, something Beverly Sills is getting ready to go on.
You know what? I've had this thing. I don't know. My voice is kind of only half here. It's on vacation.
Drink liquid plumber before you...
No, but I might. Yeah. Drain all, anything.
Yeah.
Half liquid plumber, half...
Is there a good sports story to talk about? What should we talk about?
Nothing special to talk about, except they're talking about the...
Well, you know how fuel cells are supposed to be the sort of the great hope of the future here and everything like that?
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, they've been sucked down into the cesspool of Connecticut politics, too. A $19 million project billed as the largest fuel cell energy center in the country has come under scrutiny by federal authorities investigating corruption within the John G. Rowland administration. Federal investigators have subpoenaed records from the State Bond Commission on several projects, including documents related to a fuel cell power plant. I think it's maybe the one that the Tomasos put up over there across the street. It says FSA on it. I think they misspelled cell, but it's Fuel Cell Administration.
Yeah.
No, it's not, actually. It's a fuel cell power plant built at the State Detention Center for Juveniles in Middletown, which is also being looked at.
Wait a minute. There's a fuel cell plant at a juvenile detention center?
Yes, absolutely. It's important that young criminals learn more about alternative
energy. You know something else? There's some kind of a fuel cell thing not too far from where I live.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I was walking one day, and I got on the road, and there's signs around this thing like it's like some kind of top secret, no trespassing, all this stuff. You can't even get into the vicinity of it.
Well, apparently, first of all, the Tomasa Group was the construction manager at this reform school, and in fact, there's a 200 kilowatt fuel cell thing that supplies electricity to the juvenile training school there. And Peter Eliff, Roland's former co-chief of staff and subject of the probe, and somebody who at this point is probably doing more singing than Caruso, has stepped in and changed the project from a traditional power system to a fuel cell plant. That may be what has gotten people interested in that. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But,
well, it's good because I think they really needed some other stuff to look at.
I would say at a certain point, from the point of view of Associated Press, for example, it may become simpler to list things that aren't under scrutiny here in the state of Connecticut, you know?
That would be big news.
Yeah, there may be like, you know, a couple of Mr. Donut franchises that haven't had their records subpoenaed or something. It might be better just to mention those and just assume, work backwards from the assumption that everybody has been called in front of the grand jury. And you'll probably be relatively safe there. But anyway, that's just another... at the end of the story, Representative John Larson says that the probes shouldn't deter investor and government confidence in fuel cells in general. I mean, which is a lovely sentiment. You know, please don't just assume that because the Roland administration managed to get fuel cells into, you know, the area of, you know, suspect activity by the federal government, the technology is still fundamentally sound. Oh, I'm getting punchy. Anyway, that's the latest news from Lake Wobegon about that. And we'll be back tomorrow with even more fun. But we do want to thank everybody who helped out with today's show, including we did have visits from two members of the House Select Committee, Representative Arthur O'Neill, the chairman, and Mike Waller, who's also the co-chairman of the House Judiciary Committee.
You know, if they visit here much more, people might start to talk.
Well, it's like, at this point, I'd like to think
about
that,
you?
That we've been deposed at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that we've had enough conversations with them that we shouldn't actually be called. And we'd like to thank U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman and his life partner, Arnold Dean, also our producer, Bobby Sherwood.